Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. South Korea holds its first presidential election since the impeachment of conservative Park Geun-hye tomorrow. Who are the candidates and what are they saying about peace on the Korean Peninsula? Will any of them aim to forge a more diplomatic relationship with the North, that is the DPRK? And as the U.S. THAAD missile system is deployed, what are the candidates saying about the South Korean relationship with the United States? This election will have profound consequences for Korea, the region, and the entire world. We are joined for the full hour today to discuss this issue from Atlanta by Will Griffin. He is a member of the U.S.-based group Task Force to Stop THAAD in Korea and Militarism in Asia and the Pacific. We are joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun. She's a visiting lecturer at Northeastern University, and she is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. And we are joined from Maine by Bruce Gagnon. He is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space and a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. Welcome to all of you.
Nice to be on the show.
Thanks, Brian.
Yes, good to be with you.
Simone, let's start with you. How important is this election? And with all the tension currently taking place in the region, will this have an impact on the electoral outcome?
I think that this is going to be a watershed election, and specifically not only in the Korean Peninsula, but also the entire region of Northeast Asia and also the world. All polling data and also evidence shows that Moon Jae-in, a liberal candidate and former civil rights attorney, is likely to win the election. And he is a strong proponent of sunshine policy, engagement with North Korea and diplomacy with the North Korea, and also making a clear shift from previous hardline policy. So I think this is going to be a watershed. And all the latest news shows about 11.7 million Koreans, that is about 26.07% of the electorate, had already cast their early vote. So this is one of the highest record number of Koreans, the early voting. So this, I think this will, this is a sign that Koreans are very committed and the interest in not only presidential politics and also overall change in foreign policy is huge. So I think this is, we are looking at not only impact on the election itself, but also long-term regional and also the worldwide security issue.
Professor Chun, let me just stay with you real quick for a second. The sunshine policy was a policy that was initiated by Kim Dae-jung back in the 1990s, the late 1990s. It led eventually to the June 15th historic summit whereby Kim Dae-jung, the president of South Korea, went to Pyongyang and met with Kim Jong-il, who was then the head of state in North Korea. And I would say in South Korea, in North Korea, among overseas Koreans, there was a sense of tremendous optimism that the long, terrible, tortured division on the Korean Peninsula might be coming to an end. In other words, one might start to see a light at the end of the tunnel. That, of course, was dashed, you know, soon thereafter, especially by the attitude of the incoming George W. Bush administration. But are you, as a Korean who has been working for peace, do you sense the same possible sort of neo-euphoric feeling if something like this were to happen?
I would say not euphoric, but I think the sense of hope and also more commitment. I think this time it will be more serious approach. At the time, with the year that you're talking about is, I think, really or truly, as euphoric might be the right word. Now we have, if Moon Jae-in is elected, I think he's the kind of president who will form a very experienced, seasoned, and also competent foreign policy team. Because as you know, we already had the experience and trial and errors of sunshine policy. under Kim Dae-jung and also Roh Moo-hyun. And as Moon Jae-in, the candidate Moon Jae-in already pointed out, there were, you know, there was significant progress at the time in inter-Korean relations, and there was no fear at the time, fear of another war between two Koreas. And they also, in spite of all the conservative criticism of Sunshine policy, there were concrete efforts and progress to dismantle the North nuclear weapons program and the six-party talks and multilateral framework. All this was basically shut down by this containment hardline policy by two consecutive administrations, under Lee Myung-bak and Park Geun-hye. And so I think the Moon Jae-in, the way we, the kind of the atmosphere right now in Korea is more sort of a calm and reasoned and approach. And but I think and underneath that, there is a very, 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 very strong hope and expectation.
Okay, Bruce Gagnon, the Pentagon really went into a sprint mode, sprint meaning running fast to deploy THAAD. Before the election. Why was that?
Well, I think they saw the writing on the wall. They fear that Mr. Moon will be elected and that he would not necessarily bow to the dictates of the Pentagon and the Trump administration to deploy this very provocative missile defense system called THAAD. And that is really aimed at China. We have to be honest about this. You know, the whole North Korea situation, I believe, is used as a foil by the United States in order to escalate its militarism in the Asian Pacific region to aim at China and Russia. They're the countries that the United States is really going after. So North Korea, which is really no threat to the United States at all, is used in this way. So they've feared this election and pushed forward with THAAD deployment, hoping to get it installed and making it a fait accompli. It'll be very interesting to see what the new administration in Seoul will do under the circumstances.
Well, Griffin, I want to ask you similarly. Bruce Gagnon said perhaps the big target of THAAD, the deployment of THAAD, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Missile Shield, is China or Russia, major powers that would have, I guess, missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles that would be in a higher altitude than any that might be used in an inter-Korean conflict. But even if China and Russia may be the targets, the people in South Korea, where the place where the missile shield is being deployed, they've been protesting every day. I mean, every day. And here you have an election about to take place, and the South Korean people get to choose not only a leadership, but, you know, presumably the direction of their country. And so here you have the Pentagon, which has occupied South Korea for a long time with tens of thousands of troops, rushing to deploy something that is highly controversial within society and universally rejected from the area it's being deployed. But they just do it. I mean, the U.S. acts towards South Korea like the 700-pound gorilla. It can sit wherever it wants to sit.
Yeah, I agree. And I actually just wrote an article that will be published in some online news sources. But I was talking about how Korea is a toy of America, right? We treat it like we're the big gorilla, we're the big child, and we treat Korea as this toy. And just like toys, they look at them as replaceable, and it is just a toy or a pawn in a larger scheme of things. Especially what Bruce was saying with more focus on China and Russia. I mean, look, China is the second largest economy in the world. It's not growing as fast, but it's still growing. So I mean, of course, the U.S. is going to look at that as a threat. And this THAAD issue really shows how they just use North Korea as a justification for anything. From the point of the South Koreans, THAAD doesn't really make any sense at all. THAAD, you know, stands for Terminal High Altitude, meaning very, you know, it will only protect against long and medium range missiles that are above 45 kilometers. And if North Korea were to attack South Korea, they would certainly use some type of a short-range missile that's below 45 kilometers. And not to mention, THAAD is deployed in Songju, which is in the southern part of South Korea. And the majority of Koreans, you know, live in Seoul. It's the most populated city. And it's so close to North Korea that THAAD wouldn't even protect Seoul. Clearly, the U.S. doesn't really care too much about protecting South Koreans or the country, and it has a history of doing that. You know, going back to the colonization of South Korea by Japan, where the U.S. actually supported Japan and acknowledged their rule over South Korea in the first half of the 20th century. But this issue is just highlights all of these historical issues that's been going on in the region.
Professor Simone Chun, I'm looking at a Voice of America article. It's kind of interesting because it is the Voice of America. That doesn't make it interesting, but what I'm about to say, the juxtaposition of what they're talking about, it says the headline is Trump Anxiety, an Issue in South Korean Presidential Election. And what the article is essentially suggesting is that Donald Trump's pronouncements, his bluster, his bluff, his rhetoric, his threats against North Korea, they could be impacting the electorate inside of South Korea. Do you agree with that?
Yes and no. First of all, I think that South Korea is actually, you know, South Koreans have lived with this kind of reaction or threat, lack thereof, for more than, you know, six decades. So, and also second thing you have to remember is that South Korea is emerging and also becoming in a process of being a consolidated and mature democracy. People don't react, you know, the way that other people in other countries or Americans might react. And Koreans have become very sort of rational and calm, developed a kind of democratic culture. The second point, actually, with regard to Trump, if you listen to the front runner Moon Jae-in, actually, you know, Moon Jae-in actually has taken very sort of a diplomatic reaction or moderate reaction to President Trump, and he actually, you know, respected Trump's earlier initiative. Like commented that he would like to have a hamburger diplomacy with North Korea. And Moon Jae-in also, you know, actually praised the Trump's sort of a hinting of a pragmatic approach to North Korea. And I think that it's too early. They're a little sort of taking, wanted to wait and see how the American, what kind of policy the Trump administration is going to have. But answer your question specifically, I think that North Korea, the issue of North Korea is not a huge electoral, issue. It is more subtle. But the only, I can say the only group that really sort of raising the North Korea threat is this sort of ultra-right-wing candidate and his supporters, basically saying that if we elect Moon Jae-in, you know, we're going to have South Korea is going to turn into, will be unified by North Korea. So, but I don't think people, you know, buy into that kind, most electorates buy into that kind of threat.
Bruce Gagnon, we have 3 minutes before we go to a break. I mean, it's true. Trump's pronouncements have been contradictory, which is true about all of Donald Trump's pronouncements. And so you never know with Donald Trump what's bluster, what's bluff, what's threat, what's his bottom line. So he says we're sending an armada to North Korea. If China doesn't take care of the North Korea problem, we will. He threatens North Korea with basically incineration from Trident submarines, which can destroy 24 North Korean cities and towns instantly and at the same time. He also denounced the U.S.-South Korea Free Trade Agreement as if it was something very bad for the United States. And at the same time, he turned around and said, yeah, I'd be very honored to meet with Kim Jong-un. And it was very hard for him. He was a young person who took over the head of state position in his country, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's very hard to tell with Donald Trump. So you can understand why Moon Jae-in may be like bending the tree towards, okay, I want to emphasize the positive things he said, perhaps having dialogue with North Korea.
Well, you know, I think in a way, Trump really represents the U.S. military empire in a clear way. And I think Trump, his back and forth, as you very well described, is going to help collapse the empire in a quicker way. We can only hope, though, that the collapse isn't accompanied by World War III, which is always a clear possibility in this situation. But I think people around the world are going to say that, you know, we really can't trust the United States anymore. I think a lot of people have been there for a long time with that position, but Trump will increase that view of the U.S., and I think that will be a good thing. So on the one hand, this vacillation and unclarity from Trump is confusing and is not good for making policy. But on the other hand, in terms of getting the rest of the world to quit following the United States over the cliff, quit believing the United States, I think Trump's insanity will really continue this collapsing of the empire.
All right, that was the voice of Bruce Gagnon. We're speaking with Bruce and also Will Griffin and Professor Simone Chun about the elections tomorrow in South Korea, an election that will have a profound impact on Korea, on both Koreas, on the region, and on the world. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about tomorrow's elections in South Korea. South Korea will have a new president following the impeachment of the conservative Park Geun-hye. We are joined for the full hour today to discuss this issue from Atlanta by Will Griffin. He's a member of the U.S.-based group Task Force to Stop THAAD in Korea and Militarism in Asia and the Pacific. We're also joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. And we're joined from Maine by Bruce Gagnon. He is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space and a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. Will Griffin, there is, because it is South Korea, the intertangling of the issues of war and peace, not just in Korea, but regionally. And of course, there are issues that are, I would say, local or domestic that are animating the population in South Korea because, you know, as Professor Chun said, people in South Korea and people in North Korea have been dealing with this state of near permanent crisis for a long time, for many decades. And there are many other issues like what's happening in the economy, what's happening in politics, et cetera, et cetera. But because you have a focus on militarism in Asia and the Pacific, before we turn to that question, I want to ask you, when you look at the U.S. strategy towards South Korea, including this rush to deploy THAAD, and you put it in the context of the Asia pivot, what seems to me to be clear is that it's not just about Donald Trump, because it started with President Obama. And it may not be about any of the politicians who come and go. It may be about a strategic orientation by the Pentagon towards the region, in which case Korea just is one important piece, but a piece nonetheless of this larger puzzle. How do you see it?
Yeah, so the Asia pivot is definitely a major focus of U.S. foreign policy, gaining ground with Obama in 2011 when he announced the pivot. But on the Korean Peninsula, it's become so important now that it's kind of become ground zero for the new global arms race. As Bruce mentioned, I mean, possibly World War III could be the epicenter for the next World War III. I mean, we're talking major casualties. We're talking a huge conflict that is kind of currently stirring up right now. And the majority, from my point of view, the majority of the problem is the hostility and aggression from the United States trying to enforce their so-called pivot, their policy of the pivot to Asia, or what they call now the rebalance because they thought the word pivot was too aggressive. And these policies in the entire region, specifically on the Korean Peninsula, have just it hasn't benefited really anybody except the U.S. And if war breaks out and all these military conflicts and tensions are rising, you know, the South Koreans are the ones to pay for this. Certainly, if war breaks out on the Korean Peninsula, you know, Seoul is going to be devastated. Seoul is going to be completely gone. We're talking millions and millions of people, millions and millions of casualties. And, you know, the U.S. is just going to use this conflict to stir up even more militarism, which it has done. But Asia is an important focus too economically. 40% of the world's trade goes through the South China Sea. China's the second largest economy. And interesting enough, South Korea's number one trading partner is with China, right? And South Korea's kind of been pushed into this dilemma of choosing either, you know, trade with China or more of a security standpoint with the U.S. And obviously with this THAAD issue and other military issues with the military training, the joint military training exercises going on in the Korean Peninsula, South Korea is showing signs that it is choosing the U.S. over China. And China is retaliating economically through this THAAD issue and just a pivot overall. But, you know, Moon Jae-in actually, you know, the next president of South Korea, he recently just said, as posted in the Washington Times and Washington Post the other 2 days ago, that he asked, I think that was a very important word to focus on, that he asked the United States to respect South Korea's democracy. Like, he shouldn't be asking, he should be demanding that every country respect South Korea's democracy, just as the U.S. would demand that every other country to respect our own democracy if we ever had one. But it shows an important issue of how the U.S. just dominates over the country.
The democracy that Will is talking about, respect South Koreans' democracy, it has emerged as a major force within the political reality of the Korean Peninsula. Of course, you know, I know, the world that paid attention to Korea knows that South Korea was not a democracy for a long time. Not only was it under U.S. military occupation after the Korean War, but it was an out-and-out military and a very brutal military dictatorship. That hasn't really been the change, as there's been an incremental evolution of democracy in South Korea. South Korea is the fourth largest economy in Asia, the 11th largest economy in the world. It's a mixed economy. Of course, for the voters in South Korea, they may not be thinking so much about North Korea as putting food on the table or having a bright economic future, or if they're afraid, a dim economic future. Talk about that which is animating the South Korean electorate right now. If it's not North Korea, which you're sort of suggesting that's not the number one issue for the people in South Korea, what are the big issues?
I think that the number one issue for this election is obviously the impeachment of President Park Geun-hye, who was the symbol of a corruption in a very deregulated neoliberal economy. It was in the crisis in capitalist system, where most powers were, you know, greater powers given to the corporation from the people. And so this is an impeachment, and of this election consists of correcting that previous administration. And but what that did is, although North Korea may not be the more represented as the most clear and important issue, underneath there is actually voters demanding, you know, the end of Cold War. As you know, Korea, we can argue that Korean Peninsula is the last place, you know, where the Cold War still remains. And what happened was, under the previous to Lee Myung-bak administration and also Park Geun-hye, we had two consecutive right-wing administration that sort of restored the authoritarian politics, which thrived when Korea was in the Cold War era. So what this election is about, Koreans saying, you know, we had enough with those Cold War politics. We had enough of those previous politics that, you know, a sort of puppet government of the United States. And we will end finally for good to end this, Cold War. I may be a little bit exaggerating, but that's the way I look at it. And the third will be basically Korea is becoming, Korea is this new democracy coming of age. It is, it has very strong history, memories, and culture of resistance, as you know, as demonstrated in the Candlelight Revolution, where 1 in 3 Koreans participated, hold the Candlelight protest for more than 250 days. And the Korean democracy that is very based on strong civic grassroots participation. So I think if you put those three things together, this election, just to summarize, is about, restoring sort of a normal politics, rational and reasoned politics. And secondly, ending both very corrupt neoliberal government, neoliberal economic system.
And real quick, Professor Chun, I want to also ask you, is there a generational divide politically in Korea on either the issue of reunification or relations with North Korea, or between the progressive and more conservative parties?
Older generation has obviously more stronger opinion about reunification. I think except those few right-wing conservative old generation, most Koreans would support peaceful reunification. And also the constitution actually states that about generation, let's say 30s and 40s, they would also obviously like myself, we have lived through authoritarian regime and we feel very strongly about the peaceful reunification. For younger generation, often people say the younger generation, younger Koreans aren't interested in reunification or issues concerning North Korea. But I don't think so. I think they are, I have three nephews and one niece. They are smarter. They are very mature. And they do not have they did not grow up with such negative, horrible experience of authoritarian military regime. They do not have a very strong biases against North Koreans. And so I think that actually we have this next younger generation is, I think, our biggest hope, right? Biggest hope, a generation that had no experience of horrible experience. And they still can, I think that, they will be the force of change and also the kind of generation group that they can implement more peaceful coexistence or diplomacy. So I think they're interested.
Bruce Gagnon, I want to go back again because it's hard to talk about anything in the Korean Peninsula without the overarching perspective. We're talking about the Cold War, and this is a relic of the Cold War. But in the case of Korea, the war was not cold. It was very hot. The main complaint of U.S. pilots during the war was that there was nothing left to bomb. And I think that was by December 1950 because they had carpet bombed all of North Korea so completely. When you think about it, most wars, almost all wars have a beginning. Well, all wars have a beginning and almost all of them have an end. But this war, this Korean War, is a war so far without end. Why?
Well, I think it's, as they say in business, location, location, location is everything. And I think in Korea's situation, the fact that it borders both China and Russia makes the U.S. Bases in South Korea a vital location for the U.S. militarism so that they can be close to Russia and China. It ought to be remembered that during the Korean War, General MacArthur sent U.S. warplanes over the border to bomb Vladivostok, Russia, just over the border. And so U.S. was trying to draw Russia directly into the war. MacArthur, that was his goal. And so that is really a difficult situation for the Korean people because, in a way, they've been used as a tool by the United States as a basing situation. And today now we find missile defense not only being deployed as THAAD is being deployed now in Songju, but missile defense has already been deployed in Korea at several bases, the Patriot missile. Missile defense systems on board U.S. Aegis destroyers are being ported now in Jeju Island and other Navy bases that the United States has in Korea and also in Japan. Missile defense is going into Taiwan, into Guam, and other places throughout the region. So the United States is encircling both Russia and China with military bases and these so-called missile defense systems that are used as the as a shield after the Pentagon launches a first strike attack. In fact, at the U.S. Space Command, every year for many years now, they do a annual war game where they practice a first strike attack on Russia and China. They call it the red team versus the blue team. And in that first strike attack, after the U.S. has hit Russia and China, they then try to fire their remaining retaliatory strike. And it is then that these missile defense systems are used to try to pick off that retaliatory strike, giving the U.S. a quote-unquote successful first strike. And so these bases in Korea are strategic, are very important as the United States looks to try to encircle and maybe someday even try to take out governments in Russia and China in a first strike attack. So this Korea, in a way, is, I think, suffering so badly because of its location.
Well, Griffin, I've been to DPRK several times, and one of the things that really struck me was when I came back and talked to people here in the United States, I would say, well, I just went to North Korea, and they'd say, oh, you mean South Korea? Because they couldn't even imagine somebody going to North Korea, because their image of going to North Korea meant that you were, you know, going to another planet, you know, that was inhabited by, you know, beasts or something like that. In other words, that they had a completely demonized, caricatured view of the DPRK. I was on a panel recently with Bruce Cummins, the American scholar who's perhaps the foremost American scholar on Korea. And the focus of his speech was the extreme racism that's dominated the American political discourse about Korea. We only have a minute to break. We'll come back to you after the break. But talk about the function of racism in shaping people's perceptions.
Well, racism is deeply rooted in American culture and American history, right? I mean, America was kind of built on the racism towards Native Americans and then towards African Americans with slavery, and continues to Hispanic and Latinos people, and even Asian people, and especially Chinese people with a famous Exclusionary Act, where, you know, Chinese people were limited and excluded from immigrating to the U.S. while at the same time, the U.S. was inviting everyone from Europe to come through Ellis Island and come live a new life and live the American dream and so on and so forth. But, you know, this America has essentially mastered the art of racism, right? So this demonization of North Korea and really any other person of color or gender for that fact.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Will Griffin, Professor Simone Chun, and Bruce Gagnon. We're talking about tomorrow's elections in South Korea. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Tomorrow is the big election for the next president in South Korea following the impeachment of conservative leader Park Geun-hye. She was the daughter of the former dictator of South Korea, someone who worked with the Japanese colonial forces. Now she's been ousted. We're joined for the full hour by Professor Simone Chun. We're talking to her from Seattle. She's a professor and a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. We're also talking from Atlanta with Will Griffin. He's a member of the U.S.-based group Task Force to Stop THAAD in Korea and Militarism in Asia and the Pacific. And from Maine by Bruce Gagnon. He is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space and a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. Will Griffin, before we went to the break, we were talking about how the United States media and the government, working together, working sort of as an echo chamber, have completely demonized DPRK. DPRK is ridiculed. It's treated in the worst kind of stereotyping. It's made fun of. It's like a big punching bag. It's like the Koreans who live in North Korea and their political system, you know, are just some sort of an anomaly, some sort of rogue, a rogue force. But, you know, here we are 70 years after the end of World War II when the DPRK regime took form, as did a government in South Korea. There were supposed to be elections in 1948 whereby the Korean Peninsula would be reunified. The U.S. government did not want reunification at that time because most Koreans would have probably voted for Kim Il-sung. He led the guerrilla struggle against Japanese colonialism, where the government leaders in South Korea were, for in a large part, either vassals of the United States or collaborators with the Japanese. People in the United States thus could have no sense of how the people in North Korea would do have any other feelings other than feelings of hatred against their leadership. But that, too, may be just a demonized conception, a colonialist perception. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, it's really crazy how this racism and demonization of people of North Korea, or really anywhere the U.S. really wants to go to war with or has been at war with, and frankly, I think America is kind of has run out of terms to call North Korea, right? You know, going back to the Native Americans, the U.S. called them savages, even though the U.S. committed genocide against them. So I really question who the savage was there. You know, the past decade and a half, we've been calling Arab Muslim people terrorists, even though we've been dropping bombs on innocent people. So I really question who the terrorist is there. And then now we have North Korea, and we just call them crazy. Like, I don't – maybe we've run out of terms, you know, racist terms to call other people. But, yeah, North Korea, Kim Jong-un, the whole area is just looked at as some crazy place. Like you said earlier, it's just off on another planet. And the problem was that is when people actually start to believe these terms, they're first of all, they're no longer interested in looking into the issue any deeper to actually learn, you know, say the truth of what's going on, or at least as close to the truth as possible. And two, you demonize an entire country of people, and when you demonize people, it's far easier to shoot bullets at them, to drop bombs at them, and to treat them as something as subhuman, as an insect, right? And racism is always used leading up to any type of a war. Being an Iraq and Afghanistan veteran, obviously we clearly use terms against the Iraqi and Afghani people, and which I'm deeply ashamed of doing, which is why partly I've turned into an anti-war activist, try to expose a lot of these root causes and problems within the military and its industrial complex. But I mean, James Bradley was just recently interviewed by John Pilger in his documentary, The Coming War on China. And James Bradley said, listen, if you go to Shanghai and you get on a skyscraper and you look off into the coast, you'll see U.S. Aegis destroyers everywhere. You'll see U.S. bases everywhere. You'll see U.S. soldiers everywhere. It's the same way in Pyongyang in North Korea. When they look off to their coast, they're surrounded by this military-industrial complex with missiles and soldiers and ships and bases. Now, is it the same if we go to Los Angeles or New York and we look off to the coast? Are we going to see any North Korean ships or Chinese ships or Russian ships or Iraqi or anything, right? We're not going to see any of that because the U.S. is hypocritical and has a double standard when it comes to using and exercising military power across the world.
Professor Simone Chun, I mean, that was I appreciated what Will presented, that sort of visceral sort of sense that if you're in North Korea or South Korea or Russia or China and you look outside, you can see this, you know, these U.S. military exercises, massive exercises, deployments of aircraft carriers, submarines, et cetera. I mean, Americans don't have to think about that. But let's talk again from a South Korean point of view. Moon Jae-in is likely to win the election tomorrow. He's got a 40% support within the polls. The next candidate, I believe, is like perhaps 20% lower. So, and there's no second round. Whoever wins this round will win. Now, Moon said in an April 25th debate, quote, I am confident to lead the diplomatic efforts involving multiple parties, which will lead to the complete abandonment of the North Korean nuclear program and bring the relationship between South and North to peace, economic cooperation, and mutual prosperity. So that there's a lot there, actually. And I want to ask you a couple things. One is, if the Koreas were reunified, it would seem to me, given the level of education, the culture, the shared language and shared culture and its history, Korea would become a powerhouse country, like a dominant, you know, not dominating, but a dominant powerhouse country, if it were to happen. Also, in which case, it's the U.S. would not be able to keep any part of the Korean Peninsula under its own sort of boot. But when you hear President Moon, and that's what he might be starting in the next few weeks, talk about he's confident of a complete abandonment of North Korea's nuclear program, I'm not certain that North Korea will ever give up its nuclear program under these circumstances. I could see North Korea capping its nuclear program in exchange, say, for a normalization of relations or a peace treaty. What do you think about those issues?
I think that you are right. I don't think the Moon Jae-in administration will be able to denuclearize North Korea. I don't think North Korea will give up a nuclear program. However, there is a good chance that North Korea will freeze existing nuclear programs, which I think that Moon Jae-in also suggested. Moon Jae-in will take a very step. He already said that he will take a step-by-step approach, starting from more economic cooperation. So if you want to, if I summarize his approach in one phrase, it will be more like a neoliberal North and South and also regional economic integration first, and followed by cultural, social interaction. As you know, two Koreas have been separated more than 2 decades. We are becoming now almost a different sort of a nations. So it's very important to get that national unity. And then after accomplishing those two, there may be some kind of political reunification. So I think that Moon Jae-in is talking about very long-term step-by-step approach. And to start immediately, I think that he already promised that he will immediately restart Kaesong Industrial Park, which is basically North and South economic, very successful North and South economic cooperation, which Park Geun-hye administration just shut it down without consulting anybody. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of people lost jobs. And, the Kaesong, you can build the, all the money that the trillion dollars or, you know, billions of dollars that you, you know, waste on weapons can be easily invested in economic cooperation. So that is Moon Jae-in's approach. And the second approach is that I think he's definitely going to jumpstart the diplomacy engagement. And I would say it'll be like a sunshine policy 2.0, upgrading sunshine policy. And I honestly really think that my personal opinion is that sunshine policy actually did work. It was a success. It was so successful that I think that there was a clear sort of prospect chance that North and South Korea by now would have some sort of closer to reunification. And I do believe that a lot of people were scared of that prospect. Imagine a unified Korea in the Northeast Asia. As you point out, it will be one of the most powerful countries, which no neighbors want, actually. Just like as a unified Germany was feared and a long time for opposed. So I think that going back to your question, Moon Jae-in will take a very step-by-step economic, cultural unification. And he also, I think, did raise the issue of the cost of reunification. And so I think in that regard, I hope that not only the United States and also the rest of the world sort of, help and support.
Professor Chen, again, a quick follow-up question. June 15th is the anniversary of the historic summit, the first summit in 2000. That was during the time that President Clinton was reaching out to North Korea. Kim Dae-jung had the sunshine policy, which we've been referring to. Madeleine Albright, who was then Secretary of State, actually went to Pyongyang. Here we have another anniversary coming up, and anniversaries mean a lot in Korea. They mean a lot everywhere, but in Korean culture and Korea, it seems to me that the anniversaries become the occasion for people to gather together and to symbolize things. Is it possible if Moon Jae-in wins that there will be activities around the June 15th date that will signify the desire by Koreans overseas, North, South, the desire for this kind of process to begin once again?
As you know, 70% of Koreans, right, have 70% of Koreans support engagement, Sunshine Policy. It is a fact. Secondly, even under those two hardline conservative administrations, people, not only Korean Americans here and also Koreans, we always celebrate the June 15th agreement, historic agreement. And so I think this year, I hope that there's an awesome opportunity to celebrate in a very meaningful way. And this is going to be a great new beginning. And I hope the Moon Jae-in administration and also the Trump administration cooperate. And we have, instead of delaying the major policy shift towards engagement and Sunshine Policy version 2 within 100 days of the Moon Jae-in administration. That would be my hope.
Optimism, Bruce Gagnon. I mean, all sorts of new contradictions because, as Professor Chun said, perhaps no one, meaning none of the other countries in the region or globally, would actually want a reunified Korea for different reasons. But, you know, we have these kind of this dichotomy. Trump is, you know, pounding his chest sometimes and demanding almost war against North Korea, but then also saying he'd be honored to meet with Kim Jong-un and start a process of bringing the crisis with Korea to an end. In other words, there's a lot of things in the mix right now. What's not in the mix, though, it seems to me, is the deployment of THAAD, because that's why the Pentagon rushed there. They put it there, and they're sort of saying, no matter what else happens, and we don't know, we, the Pentagon, don't know what's going to happen, but our missile shield, meaning the Pentagon's presence in South Korea, is there to stay.
Well, you know, this is going to be the biggest challenge of all for the new president. Assuming that it's going to be Moon, it's going to be a huge challenge. Will he have the guts, the power domestically to stand up to the U.S. Pentagon and say, take this THAAD out of here? It's too dangerous. It's too provocative. It's heightening tensions in the region, creating a new arms race, could lead to war. And this is going to be a huge challenge. One thing that I hope people there organizing will also begin to integrate in their opposition to THAAD is the fact that a toxin called, a chemical called perchlorate, is in rocket fuel, and it's become an epidemic across America. It's in the lettuce. It's in even organic milk. It's in the water. And perchlorate is just a massive problem. As soon as they start pumping fuel into THAAD missiles, as soon as they start storing rocket fuel, it's going to get into the water system. This whole area of Songju is a melon farming community, so that means that the water they use to water their plants, their melon plants, is going to become contaminated with rocket fuel. It's going to be an environmental catastrophe. So this issue could also really help illuminate the protests that have been going very strongly there in South Korea opposing THAAD. So it's going to be really interesting to see how the new president handles this whole issue of THAAD in South Korea.
But what Bruce is talking about is so true, because these are farmers. They're growing melons. They want to be able to sell their agricultural produce. But if people even if it's not true, if people think it might be true that their produce is going to be contaminated, that's going to be the death of their economy there. I mean, this struggle, I don't see this struggle against THAAD going away, because it's not just about war and peace. It's about people's livelihoods. We have 3 minutes. So let me ask you that, and then I'm going to ask Professor Chun to have the final comment.
I mean, THAAD, like you said, THAAD highlights the issues, the historical deep issues on the Korean Peninsula. And more importantly, with U.S. relations towards North Korea, we have to look at the consistency of the behavior and reactions. Whenever the U.S. acts with military force, North Korea does missile tests. Whenever the U.S. wants to engage in talks, North Korea freezes its program. It's very consistent. So this, obviously, with this THAAD issue, North Korea is not going to stop testing their missiles, because it's a sign of military force, military aggression from the U.S. So let's just look at the consistency of the behavior and go from there.
All right, Professor Chun, it's a kind of a symbiosis here whereby the United States, in the name of defending the Korean people from North Korea, takes actions that North Korea perceives and will continue to perceive as a nonstop threat to them, and thus they have to, because they're a smaller country, a weaker country militarily, they have to make a show of force, to which the United States then points and says, see, North Korea is being provocative. I mean, it's kind of a setup by the Pentagon to keep this kind of tension going, because perhaps it's just good for Pentagon business.
It is. It is. I have an altar near Sungju, so this is also my personal issue. And the altar is more than 100 years, survived the Japanese colonization and Korean War. So I'm very part of the resistance against the set. But I think it's going to be a long struggle. Local opposition, very strong, very heroic, very courageous, inspirational. The most important one I want to tell you, listener, is that I have been so, it's American solidarity. People like you and Will Bruce has been just amazing. So this is the way I want to think. I think that Moon Jae-in was not going to solve a problem immediately. This is a long journey. And the way, and Korean myself, I've taught course classes in the United States more than 25 years. One thing that I know is America knows very little about Korea, but I also know that from my experience, when North Korea was presented, even North Korea was presented to my students with the humanitarian concern and issues, they're truly, you know, I found a great hope. So my last statement will be that issue will be definitely with number one issue. But one thing that we can try, we have tried, is this sort of great odyssey of going this, taking this journey together, not just Korean alone. I don't think Korean alone can solve their problem. This time, I think the entire world, especially good Americans, hardworking peace activists, progressive Americans, should only with their solidarity, I think that Korean will finally, the so-called Korean problem will be solved and have some kind of a viable peace.
That was Simone Chun. She's a professor and a fellow at the Korean Policy Institute, a member of the Korean Peace Network. We've been talking with Bruce Gagnon. He is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. And Will Griffin, he is a member of the U.S.-based group Task Force to Stop THAAD in Korea and Militarism in Asia and the Pacific. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.